This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, in for Joshua Johnson. And what a week to be here for the Friday News Roundup. As always, a lot of politics to digest, but some other big stories, too. Another very bad week for those running the Catholic Church and for their victims. New numbers on America's opioid epidemic are causing further dismay. The president calls out some former intelligence chiefs and takes action against them, and the media call out the president for his attacks on a free press. To help us get through as much of this as we can and all of the news that's hitting all of us this week, a familiar crew, Shauna Thomas, Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News. Hi, Shauna.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's lead political editor and a frequent guest here on 1A.
Hey there.
Domenico, great to have you. And Wendy Benjaminson, managing editor for McClatchy, your first time here on 1A.
Yes, thank you.
Well, me too, so we'll help each other. How
okay,
about that? Yeah,
that
my first
good.
Time too. I want to start off, though, on a very serious note. A new report from a grand jury in Pennsylvania concluding that more than 300 priests and bishops in Pennsylvania sexually abused more than 1,000 children over the course of 7 decades. Now, that's according to this grand jury report that was dropped earlier this week. The report covered 6 of the state's 8 dioceses and found that church leaders at every level in Pennsylvania moved to hide the abuse from parishioners and from the law. Now, the Vatican finally responded to the report last night. Spokesman Greg Burke says the Vatican feels shame and sorrow for the abuse.
The abuses described in the report are criminal and morally reprehensible. The acts were betrayals of trust that robbed survivors of their dignity and, in many cases, also their faith. The Church must learn hard lessons from the past, and there should be accountability for both abusers and those who permitted abuse to occur.
That was Vatican spokesman Greg Burke speaking to reporters last night. Now, a line in the grand jury report also noted that there are very likely thousands of additional victims whose records were lost or who have not come forward to investigators in any way. Domenico, I want to start with you. This report comes 16 years after news of systematic abuse and torture of children in the Catholic Church first began to surface. Why this report at this time in Pennsylvania?
Well, look, First of all, I was going to mention the 2002 Boston Globe reporting right off the bat, because when they started to report that there were multitudes, you know, there were multiplier effects, that this was not just some isolated thing, and that this was going to be something that would multiply across the country in very similar numbers, even the reporters there were surprised and kind of stunned and had to kind of check and recheck what they were doing. And, you know, clearly, that's what's happened. And we're talking almost 2 decades later. And the church has been very slow to work on any of these things. And still, the church is not very transparent about, you know, what they're doing behind the scenes, what their internal documentation shows, what, if any, punishment there will be for bishops who allowed these kinds of acts to take place, or the cover-up that took place in moving priests to other parishes.
Well, talk about transparency. There was outrage in Pittsburgh. The report details decades of maneuverings by the church hierarchy to cover up abuses. Listen here to Bishop David Zubik defending the church and said that it really hasn't been hiding anything.
There was no cover-up going on. And I think that it's important to be able to state that we have, over the course of the last 30 years for sure, been transparent about everything that has in fact been transpiring. So I think that point needs to be made.
That was Pittsburgh Bishop David Zubik speaking to reporters last week. The Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, also known as SNAP, is now calling for his resignation. Wendy, Domenico mentioned transparency, and that sounds like one church official. One way to interpret his statements is, in terms of our actions after the fact, there's nothing to see here.
Yeah, and it's the scope of this scandal that is so surprising. I mean, I think Domenico's right that after the Boston Globe report, we all began to think that this was something that went on in the church. But the numbers in the Pennsylvania report and the details were so surprising and heart-wrenching. But I'm surprised that the church structure hasn't taken a more proactive stance. I mean, Pope Francis has been in for, what, 5 years now, and he is obviously opposed to this sort of cover-up and shifting priests around and things like that. And he has made statements that suggest that they ought to come into the 21st century, and so it's surprising that they haven't.
And Shauna, Pope Francis has not been flawless here at all. I mean, this nightmare in Pennsylvania reminds people that until he died in December, Cardinal Bernard Law of Boston was ensconced in the Vatican, safe from American prosecutors and from parishioners in Boston, where he was credibly accused of covering up abuse. And he was safe in the sovereign walls of the Vatican, where Pope Francis is responsible for that.
Yeah, the Catholic Church was still bankrolling his life. They were still, and they were shielding him from it. I also found it interesting that that bishop that, from the clip that you played, said that there was no cover-up. If you read some of the grand jury report, and I haven't read it because it is huge, yeah. I haven't read it all, but I started reading it when it came out. They talk about that the priests and everybody connected to it had a language in their own documentation, in the Catholic Church's own documentation, to basically cover up what was being done, so that if you were moved to another, if you were moved to another place, or you went to psychological treatment somewhere, there were certain words that you would use so as not to tip people off that this was because you had probably molested children.
They had euphemisms for almost every stage of this. It was literally a culture of cover up.
So that even their own records, even if they got called into question, would be hard to decipher, basically.
Well, let's leave this on accountability. There are thousands of potential cases, disturbing detail of specific cases of abuse by specific clergy. The report calls on the Pennsylvania legislature to get rid of the statute of limitations on child sexual abuse so that more of these priests and church officials can be held accountable. Domenico, any chance of that happening in Pennsylvania, my home state?
Possibly, except, you know, this really starts at the top. You know, it starts with Francis, and it starts with a kind of culture of change that they are going to bring, and how open and transparent and honest they're going to be about that. Because there are bishops and cardinals who have reached out to the Vatican to say, what is the process? What are the protocols? How consistent can we be? How do we apply those standards? And the church has not given very clear directions or instructions on how to do that just yet.
I want to pivot to some other stark news that we got this week from the Centers for Disease Control on the opioid epidemic in this country. The CDC reported that drug overdoses killed about 72,000 Americans last year. That's a record number, and up about 7% from the year before. Now, Shauna, Vice News has done quite a lot of reporting on the opioid epidemic. You saw this report. What do you make of just the magnitude of the numbers here?
I mean, Vice News has definitely sort of gone behind the scenes and talked to people about how it has ravaged their lives or ravaged their families. And I think when you see these numbers, then that helps it not just be anecdotal. It helps it be something that is larger, because it feels larger to a lot of people in a lot of towns that you and I don't get to go to all the time, but should go to more. But it really puts it into context that there's a problem. And I think it is also telling that the president of the United States yesterday kind of looked at his attorney general and said, hey, should we, the federal government, be suing these manufacturers instead of joining in with lawsuits with states? And there's no way to know from that one statement where that goes or what the attorney general does or what the Department of Justice does. But it clearly struck a nerve with the president of the United States.
Go ahead.
Wendy, go ahead.
Thank you. This is one area where the Trump administration, I think, is carrying out the loyalty to his base and to those parts of the country in a policy way instead of just the sort of political rhetoric that we all focus on. You know, they have opened up $1 billion in federal grant money to states to try to fight the opioid crisis. And whether this lawsuit is the way to go or not, the idea that there is an active policy for this crisis is interesting.
But let's turn to some of the politics that we saw this week. And you guys are the perfect guests for this. There were primaries all across the country, sort of the last round of primaries here, Minnesota, Connecticut, Wisconsin, Vermont, all setting up some competitive races for governor, Senate, and House seats in November. And let's start with a couple of notable governor's races. Former Minnesota Republican governor and one-time promising presidential candidate Tim Pawlenty got trounced in his bid to return to politics and the GOP nomination for governor in Minnesota. Now, Pawlenty was a moderate establishment, a critic of Donald Trump at one time, but Jeff Johnson won this. Domenico, what does this say about where the GOP is headed?
I mean, I think it says obviously that Minnesota politics have changed a lot, but so has the Republican Party underlying that. You know, President Trump lost Minnesota by less than 2 percentage points. And Jeff Johnson is somebody who has now embraced President Trump. Tim Pawlenty has said that Trump was unfit to be president. He's somebody who's been out of Minnesota, frankly, for a few years. He served 2 terms. And in those 7 years since he's left office, the Republican Party has definitely gone through a transformation and has been taken over by President Trump, frankly.
But it's more than that, isn't it? I mean, Minnesota is famous for nice. Donald Trump, for whatever his attributes, is not nice. And yet, embracing Donald Trump seems to be a success in a primary.
Well, I'm not going to get into the cultures of states in those places because—
But they're known for it. They're proud of it. And their politics is my point.
They are. But I think that there's a difference in what's happened with our politics generally, more nationally. I think a lot of our politics have moved away from being local and have moved more national. And if you're wearing the T-shirt of the party, you better sound and look and talk like the national party. That's a big change that's happened over the last 10, 15 years.
Let's move to Kansas just for a moment because Governor Jeff Collier lost his own party's nomination to Secretary of State Kris Kobach. Wendy, remind us who Kris Kobach is and what this says about the direction of the Republican Party.
Right. Well, I'll start with the direction of the Republican Party. I think that even though guys like Corker and McCain and other never-Trumpers in the Republican Party get a lot of airtime, I think the base, those who vote in the primaries, are still feeling that a Trump endorsement and being nice to Trump is what will get you ahead. And we've clearly saw that on Tuesday. Kris Kobach was the guy who ran Trump's election commission when he talked about the millions of fraudulent votes. And the thing was shut down, just sort of collapsed under its own weight. But Kobach, as the McClatchy Kansas City Star and ProPublica reported recently, he also made a career for a while of going around to small towns as a lawyer and offering his services for tens of thousands of dollars to towns that whose budgets are like $1 million and saying, I will write an anti-immigrant statute for you because Mexicans are coming and they're going to ruin your town. And some of these states fell for it and wrote statutes. The ACLU came right behind him with a big lawsuit, and some of these cities went bankrupt.
You know, Wendy, I read that story, and you know what struck me? It struck me how very Jack Abramoffian it is. If people don't remember, Jack Abramoff, the famous corrupt Washington lobbyist, made millions of dollars by telling Indian tribes who had a hand in politics that they needed him in Washington to wield power, and then got members of Congress to introduce bills that were basically dummy bills, ran back to the Indian tribe and said, ooh, you better pay me $500,000 to defeat this bill. You know, he had a racket going. And this sounds just like awfully similar.
It was just like that. And there was one little town in Alabama that I liked that decided to look this guy up when he came and offered them. And they called some of the other towns and they said, you know, danger, don't do this. And they turned down the contract. They're one of the few that were smart enough to check him out. But also we have another sort of pillar of democracy that's toppling with, or politics, I should say, with Trump, is that he endorsed a challenger to a sitting governor, a sitting Republican governor, and it worked. So I think that's part of 2018.
So for all of his similarities, perhaps, to Jack Abramoff, Kris Kobach is likely to be the next governor of Kansas, although he may be vulnerable. Shauna, Thomas, let me turn to you because I want to talk about some of the firsts that we saw in primaries across the country on Tuesday. Jahana Hayes won the Democratic primary for Congress in Connecticut, setting her up to be the first black woman to represent New England in the House. She'll probably win that race because it's a blue district. Ilhan Omar of Minnesota is one of two Muslim candidates who've won primaries in the past 2 weeks. They're in blue districts too, so both of them are likely to get to Congress. What about these candidates, and what do they say about the state of the Democratic Party?
I think it says that the state of the Democratic Party is really hoping women show up and vote, and that women are running in crazy huge numbers this time around. And I think the statistic that everyone was throwing out was that there are now 19 women on the ballot to be Senate candidate or to be senators in this election cycle, and that is breaking the record of 18 in 2012. And you're going to see even, we aren't totally done with primaries, so you could see even more women on the ballot. What's also interesting, though, is the candidate that you mentioned from Connecticut, who would be the first African-American woman to represent Connecticut, has said that she would not support Nancy Pelosi.
And she's not the only one.
As Speaker of the House, if the House were to turn over to Democrats. And she's not the only one. And so one of these things you're seeing is there is a surge of energy amongst Democrats that is undeniable. Going back to our conversation about Kansas, there are some hints that Democrats are, I'm not going to say they're going to win in Kansas, but they have overperformed in a bunch of special elections in Kansas in a way that you really have never seen before. So what we are seeing now is the Democratic Party trying to figure out where that energy is coming from and who is going to win it.
I want to move on to some of the president's lashing out this week because he chose some new targets. He has lashed out at the intelligence community before, but he got specific this week and went after John Brennan, the former director of the CIA. Here's Press Secretary Sarah Sanders announcing a new action taken by the president. She was in the briefing room this week.
I'd like to begin by reading a statement from the president. As the head of the executive branch and commander-in-chief, I have a unique constitutional responsibility to protect the nation's classified information, including by controlling access to it. Today, in fulfilling that responsibility, I've decided to revoke the security clearance of John Brennan, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Now, that choice to revoke the security clearance of former CIA chief John Brennan earned a lot of rebukes. This group includes respected retired Navy Admiral William H. McRaven, the former commander of JSOC and the guy who oversaw the raid in Pakistan that killed Osama bin Laden. And I want to read you just a couple of the words that Commander McRaven used in an editorial sort of clapping back at President Trump. He said, "Few Americans have done more to protect this country than John Brennan. He's a man of unparalleled integrity whose honesty and character have never been in question except by those who don't know him." McRaven goes on, "I would consider it an honor, Mr. President, if you would revoke my security clearance as well so I can add my name to the list of men and women who have spoken up against your presidency." Wendy, this is an incredible statement of solidarity from a highly decorated, highly respected, and as far as I can tell, unimpeachable commander of JSOC.
And he is joined by, in that letter, by George Tenet and I believe Robert Gates. I'm not sure about that one. And, you know, just the who's who of CIA directors and intelligence chiefs. I think part of the problem for the White House is in their messaging on this. I think there are moderate Republicans and others who feel there may be a legitimate argument to be made about in the waning days of the Obama administration how they handled the transition and what they told Trump about the Russia investigation and things like that. So you could make that argument, but they didn't. They said he was mean to the president, and so they yanked his clearance. And the unfortunate part about that is that John Brennan has a wealth of experience in fighting ISIS and fighting Al-Qaeda, and the professionals at the CIA and the NSA, et cetera, do not have that voice anymore guiding them through these troubling times.
Now, you, the 1A listeners, have been reaching out to us, reacting to this news of John Brennan getting his security clearance yanked by the president. Nick is a Vietnam vet, and he emails, "With regard to Admiral William McRaven standing up for what is right and what should be going on in our country, I was never more proud to be a Navy man than today. I stand with you, Admiral McRaven." We got a different view from Brian, who writes on Facebook, "The actions of John Brennan are unprecedented by a former cabinet-level official. He has actively worked to undermine the president and thereby the office of the president. He's worked to undermine a democratically elected president, and he's made baseless accusations of treason. He's a disgrace to all former government employees, of which I am one." Shauna, I would guess that President Trump is relying on people like Brian to back him up in his decision to go directly at by all counts, credible former directors of the CIA and other intelligence officials.
Yeah, I think the question, and I think Brian hints at, or doesn't hint, sort of says very clearly that Brennan has said a lot of things about the President of the United States that are not favorable to the President of the United States. And in the President's supporters can be mad about that. The President can be mad about that. But do you bring into that conversation the precedent of national security clearance and what that means to these people who have served in these jobs, who can still help the government if they have the information that they need, which is what this is designed to do? It's why they keep their clearance. Do you bring that entire apparatus of national security into a conversation about you feel badly because someone went on television and insulted you?
Now, we should hear from John Brennan directly because we've been talking about how critical he's been of the President of the United States. So let's let John Brennan speak for himself.
I do believe that Mr. Trump decided to take this action, as he's done with others, to try to intimidate and suppress any criticism of him or his administration. And revoking my security clearances is his way of trying to get back at me. I've seen this type of behavior and actions on the part of foreign tyrants and despots and autocrats for many, many years during my CIA and national security career. I never, ever thought that I would see it here in the United States.
Domenico, is there an intimidation effect here? Do you think there's John Brennan speaking for himself, but the White House also named other critics, James Clapper, James Comey, Michael Hayden, former director of the CIA and NSA, Sally Yates, Susan Rice, Lisa Page, they all have one thing in common. They've all been critical of the president.
Look, you know, I would say that clearly there's a, you know, retaliatory effect here, you know, by the president trying to shut down people who are speaking out against him. At the same time, you know, Brennan was almost baiting the president. I mean, he has said things that are unlike what you would normally hear from other past national security officials. You know, they would argue that you have a president who's unlike past presidents that they've seen before and that they're speaking out. But seeing McRaven come out and say, revoke mine, and you see General Hayden say, I guess I'm a dead man walking, he said on NPR yesterday. You know, they want this fight with the president to be able to raise their profile, because there's a lot of people in Washington and a lot of people in part of that world, national security and intelligence community world, who, you know, think that there's an attack on democratic institutions that are going on. You know, I mean, you know, not to navel gaze, but obviously the press has been part of that and is one piece of where the president's kind of gone after us. I kind of dismiss some of that as, you know, coaches going after the refs, and some coaches go after refs a little bit harder and scream and yell. And some coaches are kind of nice to them and try to get what they want. This coach or president does it a completely different way. And, you know, you've seen him go after judges. So when you think about those institutions, the press, the judiciary, national security and intelligence community, it all comes back to this president wanting to control the flow of information and want people to, you know, essentially say that he is their president and that they're going to listen to what he says and will do what he says.
You mentioned the president's attacks on the press and the press response that took place across dozens of news outlets just this very week. The decision, coordinated by the Boston Globe, to coordinate editorials across the country in hundreds of news outlets to push back on the president and explain not only to him, but of course to the broader public and their readers, why the press is not the enemy of the people and its place. The first question I have to you, Wendy, let me start with you. Did McClatchy participate in this effort? They own how many papers across
the country? McClatchy owns 30 papers that stretch from Northern California to Southern Florida and a lot in the middle of the country in the Carolinas. And yes, all 30 papers on their own. The McClatchy Company suggested that they participate. All 30 papers said yes. All 30 papers ran an editorial explaining mostly to our readers. Most of our papers are not Washington-focused, frankly. They are local-focused. And all of them wrote to their readers about the importance of a free press, the importance of not just covering President Trump, but finding the city councilman with his hand in the cookie jar, finding the Chris Kobach who's coming to your town and going to make it bankrupt through an immigration law scheme, finding out that a prisoner has been wrongfully restrained in a county jail, and the work that the San Luis Obispo Tribune, one of our papers, did to change the laws in their county. That's what a free press does. And a free press criticizes the president, and the president has a right to push back, as he did.
Domenico, did NPR participate?
Well, NPR is a broadcast outlet, doesn't have an editorial page. So there was no, kind of on-air anything about that. But we have had various commentaries on it. I mean, Scott Simon, one of our hosts, a week earlier had a pretty moving essay about the importance of a free press, which I would encourage people to go listen to. We did have several interviews with the deputy managing editor, for example, of the Boston Globe and why they were doing what they were doing. And, you know, the fact of the matter is here, you know, the president has taken attacks on the press to new heights. We saw this, you know, among various administrations. Every administration wants to control the flow of information and gets frustrated by it, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. President Trump, President Obama, President Nixon, President Clinton. You know, there were plenty of times, you know, during the Monica Lewinsky scandal that President Clinton decided to push back against the press in very harsh ways. There were times, obviously, when Spiro Agnew, who was Richard Nixon's vice president, you know, essentially deemed the press, almost the enemy of the people as well, trying to put more new restrictions on TV outlets. So, look.
But Domenico, you're not drawing an equivalency here between the nature of these attacks. I mean, every president, like you said, tries to control information, and no president loves the press.
Right.
That's not new. But this president has used the language of authoritarianism and has even singled out members of the press at his rallies and in some cases skirted up to the line of fantasizing about violence.
Yeah, this has been taken to higher levels, absolutely. We know that what our jobs are, you know, as Ben Bradley had said in the 70s when they dealt with the Nixon attacks, was that we have to hunker down and do our jobs. And I think that it's important for us to explain in ways that, to help people understand that we're neutral arbiters. They're not everybody within the media writ large is the news media. And to explain what the role of a free press is and what it would be, what this country would be without a free press, having unfiltered information from the White House.
Shauna, did Vice News participate?
No, we did not. I work primarily for Vice News Tonight on HBO, and we had an internal conversation about if we should acknowledge what the McClatchy papers were doing, and decided not to. And I think some of this comes out of one of the things we are accused of, and by we I mean the media, is that we are all sort of ganging up on the president, or we are all sort of in cahoots with each other. And there's a little bit of QAnon coming in this conversation a little bit. But I think a little of the concern is we weren't ready to say something, so it wasn't necessary that we should say something today. And I think the LA Times wrote a really great editorial themselves about that idea of why they are not participating in what happened yesterday. But I think the thing is, we're a free press, so we can do what we can do. NPR can do what NPR wants to do, and McClatchy can do what McClatchy wants to
do. That's right. I just want to circle back on one thing about other presidents and attacks, because Domenico is absolutely right. No president says, wow, I'm really glad you found out I did that.
Right.
But enemies of the people, we talk a lot about code and language. Enemies of the people was used by the ancient Romans to get rid of Emperor Nero, by the French Reign of Terror, and by Adolf Hitler to refer to Jews. It is a way an authoritarian leader demonizes a class of people or a profession. And that, I think, is where many media companies decided that, okay, this line and no further. And I think the Boston Globe, it was reported today somewhere that the Boston Globe did get a death threat.
A bomb threat.
A bomb threat that the feds are taking seriously.
Real-world consequences. Right. For anyone who thinks that this is just tough rhetoric and hitting back at your critics,
right.
When you speak in this way, it does affect the real world.
That's exactly right.
Domenico, I want to turn to the Senate on this issue because there was kind of a remarkable vote. I guess they call it a voice vote, so you didn't see senators lining up to take the roll call. But the Senate did pass a resolution this week affirming that the press is not the enemy of the people. Looks like a punch back at the president. It was unanimous. But I have to say, I did notice that resolution condemned attacks on the media, but failed to mention who was making those attacks.
Right.
Oblique.
Look, the Republican Party is in a vice when it comes to President Trump. I mean, a different kind of vice, not the V-I-C-E, but the V-I-S-E, when it comes to President Trump, because they need his base, his loyal followers, to be able to win re-election. And at the same time, in a lot of these districts where, you know, they are, that are more moderate districts, where suburban women in particular, are turned off by his rhetoric, you know, they need to show ways that they can push back. They also want to be able to, you know, uphold what they see as a free democracy. Now, I do find one irony with the Trump administration. Vice President Pence is not somebody who's known to be an anti-press person. In fact, he was, when he was in Congress, was one of the fiercest advocates of shield laws for reporters.
Sure was.
So, you know, that is a pretty fascinating thing. You don't hear him using the same rhetoric as the president.
You mentioned Ed Bradley, a former 60 Minutes correspondent, CBS News, in this discussion. And I always want to turn back to something that, that Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes said when she was asked by Judy Woodruff about a conversation she had with the president, when she asked him, why do you do this? Why do you continually talk about fake news? Why do you attack the press and call them the enemies of the people? And I'm going to read this quote because I think it's always so important to go back to what Leslie Stahl learned from the president whenever we talk about this issue. Here's the quote. Leslie Stahl, he said, you know why I do it? I do it to discredit you and demean you all so that when you write negative stories about me, no one will believe you. That's reporting from Leslie Stahl on her conversation with the president. And I think that's a great place to leave this conversation about the president's attacks on the media. Shauna, I want to come back to you. You know, we've been remembering Aretha Franklin, her amazing life, her incredible career, and of course, her music all hour long, and yesterday on 1A as well. Now, Shauna, you and I share a birthday, and that means that I've been in more than one karaoke party with you. I've heard you sing.
Yes.
And I've heard you sing soul and R&B. Yep.
But I would never try to sing the Queen.
You wouldn't, because you sing Tina Turner and a lot of other things.
This is true.
Talk a little bit. I know you love this music.
I love this music.
Talk a little bit
about
music. Yeah, and talk a little bit about her life and what these last 24 hours have meant to you.
I mean, I think the two things that I would want to note are I love that everybody, especially as, you know, Reverend Al Sharpton, Reverend Jesse Jackson have been talking to people, this conversation about what she did for the civil rights movement has been at the forefront of these conversations about what Aretha Franklin means beyond her music, and using her music to help the civil rights movement, going on tours and basically bankrolling times of the civil rights movement when they didn't have the money to make, you know, payroll. And her as a Black woman, her as someone who had the voice she had, knowing what that meant and that she could go out there, make money and help people with it, that I think that is one thing we have to hold up, even beyond the fact that she had that voice that lasted for decades and decades. The other thing I would want to say is, and everyone has sort of shared this clip online, that Grammy's performance from 1998 when she stepped in for Luciano Pavarotti and sang a beautiful opera song, which makes me tear up every time I watch it. There's some little Black girl who sat in a room with her mother and watched a Black woman sing opera, sing something that isn't necessarily accessible to all audiences or all communities, and maybe thought, hey, maybe I can do that. And she could sing soul and did sing soul, and she was the queen of soul, but she could do so many other things and taught herself piano and became, and she is a symbol for more than just soul music. She's a symbol that you can go out there, you can look like me, you can look like her, and you can do something. And that's one of the things that I take away from this moment, that we are celebrating her life and not necessarily mourning her death.
It's beautiful. President Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama said in a statement, I think, and I'm paraphrasing, America has no royalty, but we have a chance to achieve something more enduring in talking about Aretha Franklin. Well, Shauna, thank you for that recognition and for those remembrances. Well, I want to leave you with a different thought before we come to the top of the hour here on 1A. You know, in grade school, you might might have had a bully steal your lunch money, but did you ever think to watch out for the lunch lady? Well, kids and school officials in Connecticut probably should have. Police are saying that two sisters, Joanne Pascarelli and Marie Wilson, quietly stole almost $500,000 over the span of 5 years from cafeteria registers at two schools. I'm not kidding. That missing money went unnoticed until last year when one school board official filed a police complaint over the finances, and that's when the school district installed new software to account for daily cash intakes and become privy to the lunch lady heist. That's what went down. I want to thank all of you for being here. Shauna Thomas, Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News, Domenico Montanaro, NPR's lead political editor, and Wendy Benjaminson, Managing Editor at McClatchy. Thanks to you all. We'll turn to international news on the Friday News Roundup right after this.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. These days, keeping up with everything in the news is hard, whether it's politics or pop culture. American Express believes it's always easier to stay ahead when there's someone behind you. Easier to focus on what matters, to follow what interests you, to explore, to discover. And with American Express, you don't have to go it alone because they have your back. Don't live life without it.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're kicking off a new season with legendary singer-songwriter Erykah Badu.
That's why they call me Fat Belly Bella, because they never know when I'm going to be impregnated.
Subscribe now.
It's the Friday News Roundup, the global edition, and a lot has been happening around the world for us to get to. Turkey's president has blasted the United States for waging what he calls an economic war against his country. The Trump administration, for its part, has new economic sanctions in the works. President Trump turns up the heat with a tweet saying the United States is cutting back on Turkey. In the United Kingdom, a tweet by Britain's Labour Party backfires, doing little to put to rest accusations of anti-Semitism. And another deadly week in Afghanistan, this time students are the target. And the Taliban goes back on a promise to protect aid workers in Afghanistan. Joining me in the studio for the international hour of the Friday News Roundup, Natan Gutman. He's Washington correspondent for Israeli Public TV. Natan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Nina Marie Potts is director of global news coverage for Feature Story News. Nina, great to see you.
Nice to be here.
Nick Schifrin is back on the show. He's foreign affairs and defense correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Nick, it's great to have you.
Great to be back.
Now, I want to start with Turkey because there's been a big back and forth between Turkey and the United States, especially through the White House. Tensions have continued on a downward spiral this week. The relationship between our two countries, two NATO allies, has been souring for a while, and Turkey's economy has been as well. Now, President Trump announced in a tweet last week that he would raise aluminum and steel tariffs on Turkey. Then he tightened the screws yesterday, warning Turkey this week to expect more economic sanctions if it doesn't hand over a detained American evangelical pastor. Nick Schifrin, just how bad are relations between the United States and, as I said, its NATO ally, Turkey?
Bad, period.
How did they get this way? Erdogan, Recep Erdogan, the president of Turkey, and our President Trump were very tight. They were peas in a pod. They were two similar guys who liked to lean on the press, attack their critics. They were similar dudes, and they are not getting along.
So they were similar dudes, and they are similar dudes. And that actually created a friendship or relationship between them, but is now going to make this crisis even worse. So this is the worst crisis that the U.S. has had with Turkey in at least 5 or 6 decades or so. And as you mentioned, Pastor Brunson is the just short-term reason for this, that the Trump administration has come out hard on Turkey to try and release him because, as the president revealed yesterday, he made a deal with Erdogan to help release a Turk from Israeli custody. And he said, the president says, that in return, Erdogan promised to release Pastor Brunson. President Trump does not like being neglected on his promises or people not living up to their promises. And this is why, in the short term, some of this pressure has come along. But we've got longer term problems with Turkey. One, Syria. Two, Russia. There is a big attempt to try and get S-400s, which could threaten U.S. F-35.
Surface-to-air missiles.
And you've got a lot of tensions as well over Iran. So Turkey has things that they're doing and things that we're doing that have created this tension. And let me mention also Syria. We're supporting the Kurds in Syria. The Turks call them terrorists. So there's a lot of tensions long term, but the short term is Pastor Brunson, and relations are really bad.
And the White House has been making a lot of politics over Pastor Brunson because he is a cause célèbre in the evangelical community, a very important part of President Trump's base. Now, President Trump and members of his cabinet let America listen in a little bit on some of the administration conversation around Turkey. Listen to the president and his Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin.
How are you doing with sanctions on Turkey? And as you know, we doubled up the tariffs on steel and aluminum. Aluminum will happen very shortly. How are you doing with sanctions, please?
Sir, we're doing well. As you know, we were very clear with our counterparts there, both Secretary Pompeo and myself, on the release of the pastor. We've put sanctions on several of their cabinet members. Working with you, we have more that we're planning to do if they don't release him quickly.
Now, Nina, as Nick said, this is a complicated problem with about 17 layers, and I'm being brief about that. But here you hear the president and his cabinet for the cameras really making this about Pastor Brunson. Who is he?
Well, the pastor is, as we know, an evangelical Christian. He's accused by the Turkish government, by President Erdogan, of having had links to the Gulenist movement. And he's been identified as having had some sort of role in the coup against Erdogan. I think the question in this escalating row between the U.S. and Turkey is how much Erdogan's refusal to budge and refusal to release him is going to cost Turkey. I think some would say that Turks have been held hostage in this, and it's a very difficult, I think, to you can't really overestimate how deep sentiment runs back in Turkey. And we've seen footage circulated this week, and especially in this question of a boycott on US products and iPhones, footage of young men in Turkey smashing iPhones up and declaring their allegiance to President Erdogan and accusing America of imperialism. On the other hand, you also have Turks whose businesses are suffering, who are too scared to be named in news reports to speak up and tell people that their businesses are suffering because they're afraid of retribution, of being locked up in jail. And they are losing hand over fist money. They can't, make a living because the products in their shops have gone up by 30%.
Nina points out, and quite rightly, that Turkey's economy is doing very, very poorly. The lira has plummeted. How much of an effect do these U.S. sanctions have on the real economy of Turkey, or is it mostly political and rhetorical and giving Erdogan a good target for blaming his economic woes?
Well, it definitely has an effect on the economy and on the daily lives of Turks, mainly because of the effect that we've seen in terms of the currency. Once President Trump started ratcheting up the sanctions, the tariffs, and now he's threatening with more sanctions, the Turkish lira just plunged to a low that it hasn't seen in years, and that's affecting people holding savings. Actually, Erdogan had to reach out to the Turkish people and tell them, sell your dollars, sell your gold, and buy Turkish liras just to save the currency. Now, he did have some relief this week when the Qataris stepped in and provided him with $15 billion. That's a drop in the bucket, but it's still enough to change the trend a little bit, or at least to help him stabilize the country and to live up to his promise, which he made last week, basically saying to the United States, we have other allies. We don't need the United States. We can turn to other directions, namely Qatar or Russia.
Natan mentions the Qataris, Nick. What motivates them? Now, $15 billion may not be a lot of money to the Emir of Qatar. I get that. But they seem to be taking the opportunity to stick a thumb in the eye of the United States, who has sided, and we're getting complicated here, but it is a complicated situation, sided with their rival Saudi Arabia pretty clearly.
Yeah, I mean that's certainly part of it. The regional dynamics, the messages that Qatar wants to send toward Saudi and toward Turkey. But I don't think we should overestimate or overstate the impact of $15 billion. The Turkish problems go way beyond $15 billion. And frankly, the ability of the U.S. the president, especially through Twitter, to turn the screws is much, much higher than $15 billion. This is a question of whether Turkey is a strategic ally to the United States. There are a minority of experts here in D.C. And elsewhere who say, you know what, the world's changed and Turkey's no longer what it used to be. But the majority of people say, well, wait a minute, the influence of Turkey on Syria, right when we're getting toward the end game in Syria, the influence on Turkey on Russia, whether Turkey has both high capacity Russian surface to air missiles and U.S. jets as a NATO ally, influence on Iran. So most of the people do believe that it's important that U.S. and Turkey continue to work together, continue to work on this relationship, which is really at peril over seemingly one pastor. I mean, there are structural problems, but one pastor has pushed this to this point.
Now, you talk about alliances and you talk about NATO, and motivations are a key part of this. We got a note from Harriman, who writes on the 1A website, "While I must admit I like Trump going to bat for American citizens, that might be a cover for his task of sabotaging NATO by infuriating Erdogan so much that he withdraws from it." I'm not sure that's really going to drive Turkey away from an alliance, but it is an interesting thought about competing motivations from Harriman on our website. Let me take us to Italy, because there was a horrible and a dramatic event in Genoa in the north of Italy. The Morandi Bridge collapsed, confirmed death of 38 people. Search of survivors beneath the rubble continues, and it's garnered international attention. Nita, what caused this bridge to collapse? And there were warning signs.
There were warning signs, and they go back quite a long way. I mean, I think that the issue here is that with any natural disaster, human disaster, it can often, you know, redefine a nation, it can traumatize a nation, but also reveal a catastrophic series of mistakes, and that clearly seems to be the case in this bridge in Genoa. As you say, 39 people killed, scores are wounded, and extraordinary stories of survival. I think if you think about the Grenfell Tower fire and the speed with which people died, and the horrifying revelation that there were construction flaws and a failing safety system in place, the ineffectiveness of the political response in the
England.
UK. I mean, that will have repercussions, I think, for years in Britain, and the same could be true for Italy. This could be one of those defining moments. I mean, there's also the question of what a populist government, and in this case, a new populist government, does, which has been anti-infrastructure project and, you know, anti sort of state intervention. You know, what does it do when there is an actual crisis and its people want a government to act?
Italy has a new populist government. You mentioned it. Now, it appears that there were warnings as far back as 2013 to at least a regional form of the Five Star Movement in northern Italy, that bridge may be in danger. And this is now informing a whole new angle of the debate in that country.
Yeah, it's very bad news for the new populist government. And the warnings, as you say, did go back. And they were warnings that weren't just ignored, but they were also mocked and never taken seriously. I mean, I think that successive governments in Italy, it's, you know, widely known, have failed. And it's a very painful juxtaposition, I think, for Italians. And I'm not just talking about, you know, under a populist government. I lived in Italy at the very beginning of the Berlusconi era, and it's painful for Italians because they live in an exquisitely beautiful, sophisticated country which is deeply dysfunctional. My mother happens to be Greek. There's a joke in Greece that Italy has the same problems with tax avoidance and a dysfunctional state. They just happen to be richer. So I think that for Italy and for this populist government, it's first big crisis, and it doesn't look good.
Natan, there have been implications as well, some on the other side of the political spectrum in Italy blaming the infrastructure problems on Italy's membership in the EU. It seems like everybody's taking a political opportunity here.
Of course, this is an opportunity because of the magnitude of this tragedy, and also because of the way it played out in the political system, the fact that there were political parties running on a platform of opposing new motorways that would actually bypass this. The question of investment in infrastructure, the question of the amount of privatization you see as opposed to government involvement in infrastructure, all these play out. And now the government, as we heard, is in this awkward position where it has to defend its actions and at the same time somehow pour in money and get more involved in these local infrastructure projects.
Just a very quick point. concrete with reinforced steel. It's the most widely used building material in the world. This story is not only about Italy. Bridges built 50, 75 years ago. Cars are bigger now. Trucks are bigger now. Weather's more extreme. 54,000 bridges in the U.S. There's a report that are structurally deficient. 1999 study, 30% of road bridges in Europe have some sort of defect. So we got to worry about that as well.
Yeah, we can talk about Europe all we want. I point people to Minneapolis, Minnesota in our own country. A catastrophic bridge collapse on the interstate just a few years ago. Nobody in Minnesota has forgotten about that. And that is just the tip of the iceberg for crumbling infrastructure in this country. Makes you wonder if a catastrophic type of situation like the one we saw in Italy might be around the corner here. I want to bring us to two other English-speaking countries. There have been two controversies that we should mention that have been dominating the news, both in the UK and in Australia. Now, one concerns anti-Semitism. The other is Islamophobia. This week, an Australian senator refused to apologize for invoking the term final solution in his maiden speech to Parliament in Canberra. Fraser Anning called for migration bans on Muslims to Australia. He since claimed that he was unaware of the historical ties to the Nazis and the Holocaust for his term final solution. Here's how that fight got started.
We have ISIS sympathizing Muslims trying to go overseas to fight for ISIS. And while all Muslims are not terrorists, certainly all terrorists these days are Muslims. So why would anyone want to bring more of them here? The final solution to the immigration problem, of course, is a popular vote.
Natan, you report in Israel and for Israelis. You report in the United States for Israelis. Give me a sense of what the utterance of the term final solution means.
Well, of course, for anyone with any understanding or historical knowledge of the Holocaust, this is, of course, the name the Nazis gave to the final solution, the extermination of the European Jewry, which was carried out during World War II and led to the murder of 6 million Jews. And it's not a term used lightly, and it's not an unknown term. So I think at least here in the United States, and I'm pretty sure that in Australia too, anyone who invokes the term final solution is acutely aware of the fact that it has a very important historical significance.
Now, Anning's political opponents denounced this speech as disgraceful. Here's the Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Turnbull.
There is no place in Australia for racism. We are the most successful multicultural society in the world. We are a migration nation. Our immigration program is non-discriminatory. Senator Anning's remarks are appalling. I condemn them and I reject them in their entirety.
Nick Schifrin, he condemns them and they're appalling. He condemns them in their entirety. Still, this MP, Fraser Anning, must have had a sense that invoking the term final solution would be effective, that it was something that somebody, some constituency in Australia would want to hear. What's going on down under?
Yeah, I mean, I don't pretend to know that he knew or did not know what the words meant. But obviously, he is trying to reflect or tap into, at least, a base in Australia and, frankly, a base that we've seen in Europe and the United States. Call it Islamophobia, call it pointing out that many terrorist acts, certainly not all, many terrorist acts are by Islamist radicals is something that plays well. And in Australia and in Europe and in this country, we have seen politicians use that fear of terrorism to try and rally a base and use that fear of terrorism to try and paint an other, trying to create an other and in order to rally that base and increase votes. So, frankly, I see this in the context of some of the things we've seen in the United States and Europe.
Nina?
Well, I would just say that if you look at political tactics at its most basic level, I mean, it turns out that dog whistles do actually work. But if you're going to go down the route of ethno-nationalism, you need plausible deniability. And he went too far. His problem was that he gave too much away. He was disowned by Pauline Hanson, who is the leader of One Nation, which is a white nationalist party. And by the way, One Nation 20 years ago, it was all about Asians. They've forgotten Asians now. Now they talk about Muslims. But she says his comments have nothing to do with her. His mistake was to use language that was explicitly too racist. And I think that raises an interesting question, which is there a point at which populist leaders go too far? Is there a tipping point, which they suddenly realized the public is not up for what they're saying.
Now, you say gave away the game because when they go too far, there's a revelation there, right? The language isn't coded enough. The sentiment may be the same.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, it makes me think about rising xenophobia and Islamophobia in this country as well. Our cultures are very similar, very, very far apart, geographically separated by an ocean. But are we seeing a very similar politics in Australia to what we've seen on the rise here in the United States, even if we haven't had a politician say Final Solution?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think that's a difficult question. And I think the context here in the United States is very different. I mean, I think if we could segue into the situation in the UK, it might be a moment to discuss Jeremy Corbyn and what's been happening this week. But perhaps you want to pick up that
point. Yeah, let's do that right now. And I thank you for the help, Nina, because that's exactly where I was going. Another broadcaster always helps. And I definitely appreciate it because Nina's referring to Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition Labour Party. There's been an issue that's dominated headlines in the British press and divided his party at a time when the British government is riven with splits over Brexit. This is all about elements of anti-Semitism within Corbyn's party and what he's been able to do about it. Now, this crisis has deepened this week when Israel's prime minister attacked Jeremy Corbyn over his apparent presence at a ceremony to honor the perpetrators of the Munich terror attacks on Israeli athletes in 1972. And Benjamin Netanyahu said the Labour leader deserved unequivocal condemnation for laying a wreath at the grave of one of those behind this atrocity. There is, we should say, some confusion about who exactly was being commemorated at this ceremony, whether Jeremy Corbyn knew it was for Munich terrorists or whether it actually was proximity in the cemetery, who was actually being honored. Nevertheless, Jeremy Corbyn hit back, saying that what did deserve unequivocal condemnation was, quote, the killing of over 160 Palestinian protesters in Gaza by Israeli forces since March. Natan, what's going on here? And are Israeli leaders and news consumers really latched onto this story?
Oh, definitely they are. And I think Benjamin Netanyahu found here a point in which he can refer to the issue of anti-Semitism in the British Labour Party while actually looking at it from the Israeli perspective. Although, in a certain way, he's also playing into the hands of Jeremy Corbyn, who is walking this thin line, trying to say all the time, it's not about anti-Semitism, it's about criticism, legitimate criticism in his eyes of Israel. The problem with Corbyn, of course, is that this is not an isolated event. He said that he attended the ceremony in Tunis. He didn't know exactly who they were commemorating there, but it's not isolated. We can look at other data points from the recent months. Last month, he led the Labour Party to reject globally accepted definition of anti-Semitism, which included also definitions that referred to denying Israel's right to exist as a form of anti-Semitism. He refused to accept that, bringing about a very strong reaction from the Jewish population in the Great Britain. The three major Jewish newspapers in London actually issued the same opinion piece warning against the threat of anti-Semitism under Corbyn. So he's been plagued by these accusations for a long time. And even though he had many exit points in which he could clarify, in which he could put an end to it, Corbyn chose not to do so. Right now, the party under pressure is reaching a point in which it may retract on the definition of anti-Semitism and accept the international definition. But Jeremy Corbyn is basically dragged into that point, kicking and screaming.
Nina, give me your sense of the state of the Labour Party, the opposition party in Britain right now. Natan mentions, and he's quite right, that criticism of Israel and its policies is not on its own anti-Semitic. But Jeremy Corbyn has a track record. He has a track record of putting himself politically next to anti-Semitic figures in British politics. So this is a flare-up that gets in the news, but it's not a new story.
I think the first thing to say about Jeremy Corbyn is that he is so clearly not ready for prime time. Mm. I mean, imagine if this had happened while prime minister. And I think to your point about the fact that he's been flirting with the anti-Israeli, anti-Zionist radical left for years, it's sometimes very difficult to draw the distinction between that position and anti-Semitism. I mean, I'm not sure that Jeremy Corbyn himself understands the difference. He's kept, as you said, some very dodgy company. over the years. He has in the past described members of Hamas and Hezbollah as friends, and he is tearing the party to pieces, not least because Labour has a tradition of anti-racism, and his predecessor, Ed Miliband, is Jewish. We sent a team out in London this week to interview members of the Jewish community. Jeremy Corbyn has not got out in front of this. He has completely failed to reach out to the Jewish community. They are afraid. We interviewed a prominent media lawyer in London and his wife, who has been attacked for calling out anti-Semitism. They are packing their bags and leaving Britain. And Jeremy Corbyn has been rolling his eyes and changing his story and just simply unable to respond to these to these fresh new pictures that came out on Monday.
Not ready for prime time, Nina, as you put it. Nick, why don't you help me move us to Afghanistan and a discussion of the Taliban? The United States reportedly has been in secret talks with the Taliban trying to reach a political settlement to that long, America's longest war in Afghanistan. Now, this week, the Taliban announced that it's withdrawing protection for the International Red Cross. The Taliban says the aid organization failed to properly monitor and care for prisoners on a hunger strike in a jail in Kabul. Connect the dots for me here.
The dots are that the Taliban are trying to prove to both Afghans and to Americans that they have leverage as these talks begin. We shouldn't call them talks necessarily. They're probably talks about talks. They're not reportedly. They are happening or they have happened between U.S. officials and Taliban representatives in Qatar. But they are not any kind of discussion about how to bring peace to Afghanistan. They are a discussion about how to have a discussion in the future about some kind of talks. But they are beginning. And what U.S. and Afghan officials tell me is that this actually has a chance because there's elements of the Taliban that do want this. And the U.S. administration is on board with these talks. So as we begin these talks, which both sides believe, hey, this could actually yield some fruit in the future, the Taliban says a few things. One, we have to remind Americans and Afghans that we have power. And so we've seen not only this split with the Red Cross, which the Taliban have talked to for years, but also attacks on Ghazni and Kabul across the country that are just horrific. And some of those are ISIS, but still these Taliban attacks. And so they're proving to, or trying to prove to the U.S. and the Afghans that, hey, we still have leverage, we still have power, and also trying to prove to themselves, to some of their own fighters who are worried about nascent peace talks, that, hey, stick with the plan, we can use violence, and we can maintain our popularity and control of land.
And in a practical sense, in the immediate sense, what does it mean for the Red Cross and for their ability to operate in a war zone?
The Red Cross and the Taliban have always talked. They will continue to talk. Right now, they cannot operate until the Taliban give them the green light. Certainly, Red Cross officials are hoping that the Taliban will once again give them the green light because the Taliban has done that many times in the past.
Now, this is a good moment to move us across the border to Pakistan, integral in Afghanistan's well-being and its future, or its lack of well-being, if you like. Imran Khan, who was sworn in as Pakistan's prime minister over the weekend, he's the former cricket star. He ran his campaign on anti-corruption. Natan, who is Imran Khan, since most Americans don't follow cricket probably as closely as they should, and maybe don't follow Pakistan as closely as they should?
Definitely. He's a cricket star, a national star in Pakistan, but he made the transition into politics in a very calculated way. He didn't just helicopter into the political sphere and run for presidency. He's been building his political stature for a while already and using his celebrity status to actually build a platform and a credo of taking care of the poor Pakistanis, trying to deal with the economic crisis the country is in, promising a type of Islamic social safety net to the country. All this focus, and at the same time being critical of the United States, because that is a sentiment that does play well with the Pakistani public and actually crosses party lines there. The fact that they feel that the United States is leaning too heavily on Pakistan, and of course the Americans would say the Pakistanis aren't cooperative enough in the war against terrorism.
Stay with us. We have more in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Before you can start your day, you like to know what's happening in the news. That's what Up First is for. It's the morning news podcast from NPR, the news you need to take on the day in just about 10 minutes. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Nick Schifrin, I want to bring us back to Pakistan for just a moment before we move on in the world. We talked about the ascension of Imran Khan as prime minister of Pakistan. At the same time, relations with the United States have been poor for a very, very long time, and they seem to be getting worse as we try to negotiate our exit from their neighbor, Afghanistan. Pakistan has always been integral in the U.S. relationship and its entanglements in Afghanistan. The United States has suspended security assistance to Pakistan now, including military training. And like we talked about with Turkey at the top of the hour, it seems like bad relations are getting worse.
This is the question, though, when it comes to those bad relations, and they are bad. Will the real Imran Khan please stand up, right? Is Imran Khan the person who a few weeks ago, when he was basically elected prime minister before it was official today, gave a very reasonable, sober speech about needing to work with the United States and work with China at the same time? Or is Imran Khan the politician, the populist who came back to the country a couple decades ago, established himself as Taliban Khan, as one of his nicknames goes, and frankly gave a speech just a few hours ago in which he was much more strident and much more aggressive at what he calls Pakistan's opponents, which happen to include the Americans. And so we don't know how he's going to govern. But this relationship has been bad for a long time. The Trump administration has largely given up on that, largely given up on trying to make it better. And it is a critical moment, as people in AFPAC like to say, because the U.S. is trying to stabilize Afghanistan with a new strategy in the last year. And Pakistan makes or breaks Afghanistan's future. We just don't know which Imran Khan will lead Pakistan, but it does not. There are no signs yet that he wants a true, more open relationship, and there are certainly no more signs that he wants to crack down on the groups that use Pakistan as a safe haven to attack Afghanistan.
And we got some Iran news this week. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo unveiled a new team to coordinate the Trump administration's post-nuclear deal approach with Iran after tearing up the P5+1 nuclear deal. Here's the Secretary of State talking to reporters about what's called the Iran Action Group. Listen.
Our hope is that one day soon we can reach a new agreement with Iran. But we must see major changes in the regime's behavior, both inside and outside of its borders. The Iranian people and the world are demanding that Iran finally act like a normal nation. The Iran Action Group will drive daily progress on these objectives, and I hope do much more.
Nina, the Iran Action Group, a little layer of American bureaucracy or actually the spear tip of American policy toward Iran?
It's very hard to tell. I think we have very little detail. I mean, I would just say that from the European point of view, there is intense frustration because the Europeans have still not got the answer that they keep posing the question to the American administration, which is, what have you got better than the Iran deal? What are you going to replace it with? And people like Kushner keep saying Iran is a very bad country. And that is the answer that the Europeans keep getting. And the irony is that, of course, he has torn up a deal that, you know, he's trying, I think, in the context of North Korea, you know, I don't think we can get close in terms of a better deal. And I think it's very problematic, certainly from the European perspective.
Natan, the United States is the only nation in the P5+1 that pulled out of the Iran deal. New sanctions and new pressure on Iran. But nobody else in Europe who was party to that deal wanted the deal to end. Does anyone have a sense of what next steps from the United States may be, aside from naming a gleaming new Iran action group?
Well, this is part of the task of this new action group, or at least the action person right now there. It's not really clear how big this group is. The next stop will be in November, when the second and more significant round of American sanctions will go into place. And these are what used to be called, during the Obama administration, the crippling sanctions, shutting down the access to the banking system and to oil exports from Iran. The difference is that during the Obama administration, you actually had the diplomatic effort before to make sure that the entire world is behind you. And right now, the job of this special task force and of the administration would be to get the international community behind the sanctions. Now, you have seen some progress. You've seen major European firms pull out of Iran because they're afraid of their business with the American market. But still, and it goes back to Qatar and Turkey that oppose the Saudis and the Americans on this issue. And there are many loopholes here for the Iranians to keep on doing business if the United States is not successful in actually reaching out to every country. And that means not only Europe, but also developing countries and also Japan and India, and making sure that all of them actually shut down their ties with Iran.
Nick, Iran Action Group, who's in charge here, Mike Pompeo or John Bolton, the national security advisor? It doesn't matter.
Well, actually, there's less daylight between them. So I think it's not clear on Iran, at least, that it matters. Who's in charge of this group is Brian Hook. And this is why, to a certain extent, this is a little bit of rearranging the deck chairs, which is why we need to focus on the larger strategy. Brian Hook is the director of policy planning at the State Department, now special representative for Iran. It's just a new title. He's still doing the same job, leading this group. As Natan said, we don't even know how big it is. So the larger question is, what is the U.S. strategy? And it seems to me, talking to a lot of U.S. officials, they're just trying to break Iran economically. And to get what is the question. A lot of people read John Bolton's and Mike Pompeo's old writings and say, well, you want regime change. They say, no, we're just trying to get either behavior change or, as the president has suggested, to get Iran to the table. Either way, what they're trying to do is trying to get past November, and they will be crippling sanctions on Iran's economy, which is already weak, and they are waiting to see how Iran responds to that, whether Iran is willing at all, probably unlikely, to pull back on any proxies that it uses throughout the Middle East, or somehow come to the U.S. hat in hand and say, actually, we want to renegotiate a nuclear deal. Probably to a certain extent in this year, none of those are likely. But what the U.S. is trying to do is get Iran to force itself within the debate inside the government, inside the country, to choose one of those two things. It's unclear if the U.S. strategy will work.
I want to thank all of my guests who are sitting around the table with me. Nina Maria Potts, Director of Global News Coverage for Feature Story News. Nick Schifrin, Foreign Affairs and Defense Correspondent for PBS NewsHour. And Natan Gutman, Washington Correspondent for Israeli Public Television. Thank you all for being here. It's been a pleasure. And thanks for sitting in with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Joshua Johnson is back on Monday, so I want you all to have a very, very good weekend until Joshua comes back to sit with you again. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A.